Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny, very pleased to be with you this Sunday morning. Coming up on today's program, we've got Senior Voices and Poor Will's Almanac, and you'll hear more from our Scratch Innovation Series. Up first, data indicates that the Dayton area has some of the highest rates of infant mortality in the country. Health officials say the problem is often related to premature birth and low birth weight. Now, in an effort to bring infant mortality rates down, the Dayton Police Department is joining forces with a home visiting program for families with newborns and young children. Dayton Police have partnered with the Help Me Grow Brighter Futures program run by the Greater Dayton Area Hospital Association. It's part of a statewide program to offer pre- and postnatal health services for high-risk families. In this interview, Major Wendy Stiver with the Dayton Police says their involvement in the program made sense once she looked at local infant mortality data for a three-year period.
What's interesting is that Chief Beal had already established partnerships with our public health department and people in the public health community in relation to the opiate epidemic and had been very forward-thinking on that. And so I reached out to some of those partners that were already working with us on analyzing the opiate epidemic, and we decided to take a deeper look at what was going on with infant mortality specifically in our community. We did a research project and looked at 3 years' worth of data. That data told us that in nearly 100% of the infant mortality cases in our community, there was some contact with the police during the pregnancy. We also looked at prenatal care numbers and saw that a very low number of those parents in prenatal or in infant mortality cases were going to prenatal care appointments. It was something like 60% in the first trimester. That number dropped to 6% in the second trimester and was 0% in the third trimester for those cases that we looked at. So we saw an opportunity to somehow leverage all of these police contacts in these families to do something different. We eventually connected to Help Me Grow Brighter Futures, which is a nurse home visiting program. And we launched a pilot project in February. We identified the neighborhoods in our community where we're seeing the highest numbers of infant mortality, and we're working to solicit referrals from officers. As they go out into the community and they have contacts with newer expecting moms, they're referring those cases to a single officer. That officer then screens the referrals, passes them on to the nurse home visiting program, and once a month, our officer will go out with a representative from Help Me Grow Brighter Futures to do follow-up visits and try to get more moms enrolled in this program. Nurse home visiting programs are evidence-based solutions that demonstrate, that evidence shows that not only do they help to promote more stable families and healthier birth outcomes, but they're also evidence-based programs to reduce juvenile delinquency in the community. So there's actually, and I know it took us a long talk to get here, but there's actually a correlation between promoting healthy birth outcomes and reducing juvenile delinquency and crime in our communities. So this really is an important project for us to be involved in.
You mentioned that nearly 100% of infant mortality cases were ones in which officers had contact with that specific population. That could be as simple as a traffic stop, correct?
Yeah, actually, and about 55% of those contacts were enforcement contacts in traffic stops. I looked at a lot of these cases in depth, and there were, anecdotally, there were instances where maybe a expecting mom was a witness to a crime and was interviewed by a police officer as a witness to a crime. There were cases where, there was one case in specific that stands out where the father in an infant mortality case was a passenger in a car driving past a house that exploded. And because of that incident, our officers completed a report and interviewed the father in relationship to that report. Not every one of these contacts are necessarily going to produce an opportunity for intervention, but we know that there's a correlation that we're having contact with these families, and therefore we have an opportunity and almost a moral obligation to try to intervene and help connect them to better resources.
And let's talk about how that intervention might proceed under this new collaboration.
So what we're working with right now is we're kind of testing the waters to see how well this referral process works. We're seeing a lot of the referrals are actually coming from domestic violence type calls and incidents. And so it gives us an opportunity to send our officer out to make a second contact with someone and not just try to make the referral into the program, but also to do a little customer service work. We're out there asking and checking up to see if their initial experience with the police was what we want it to be, that if they called us or we were there, that it met our standards or expectations for customer service. So that's just part of it. And then we're working with epidemiologists from the Wright State Master of Public Health Program, as well as the Dayton Montgomery County Public Health Department, to analyze the data and look at what impact we can have with this particular approach. If we start to see that it's effective in connecting the dots and bringing more of our community members to the program and connecting them with services, and we're moving the needle on that access to healthcare part of it, we'll expand that and look at doing it with a larger part of the city.
And are you looking for help from the community on this?
Absolutely. You know, Help Me Grow Brighter Futures is an awesome program. And, you know, anybody, they don't need to have police involvement, of course, to get involved in it. But if anybody is aware of a situation where there is a parent, either a new or an expecting parent or family, that might benefit from access to these services, we'd love to hear from them. You know, we're building a structure to, like I said, help connect those dots and provide services to folks that may not know that the services are available to them. You know, in a big way, we really want people to understand and see that policing a community is not just about enforcement. It has a lot to do with identifying problems in our community and looking at opportunities to provide solutions to those problems or create solutions. We're not always going to be the solution to every problem, but through partnerships with public health and other resources in the community, we can do a better job of supporting the community, building healthier families, and, you know, hopefully seeing downstream a positive impact in our neighborhoods. If families have better access to support services, and they're able to experience healthy birth outcomes and positive starts to building a family, we're hoping that foundation will build upon itself and reduce the likelihood that we're going to be visiting those families again in other forms of crisis.
Is this a partnership that's taking place in other cities, or is this something that other communities might be watching to see how successful it is here?
When the chief assigned me to work on this, the first thing I did is I went looking for other ideas in other communities to see what else other communities were doing. Up in Milwaukee, there's been a lot of attention focused on this same issue, and there's been some training with the police department to have an awareness for infant mortality factors like safe sleep issues. I'm not aware of any other police department doing anything like this right now. I had the good fortune to talk about our research at Arizona State University last year, and I'm headed up to George Mason University in the morning to talk about it there at the Center for Evidence-Based Policing Symposium. And so there's a little bit of an interest with that community in this project to see what kind of outcomes we see, in the hopes that this is a promising approach that might be transferable to other communities.
Major Wendy Stiver with the Dayton Police Department, thanks for your time and the information, and good luck with the program.
Oh, thank you very much. Thanks for stopping by.
Ohio is located within one day's drive of more than half the country's population. This fact is often touted by development officials looking to boost the state's economic profile. It's also a favorite talking point among many Miami Valley business leaders. They say the proximity to interstate highways gives Dayton an edge in attracting investment. In today's installment of our Scratch Innovation Series, WISO's Jess Mador takes us inside one company where Dayton's location is key to the bottom line.
Governor John Kasich talks a lot about Dayton's place in the country's supply chain. Here's Kasich in his State of the State speech last year.
Why is Ohio at the epicenter of all this? Its location. 600 miles within 60% of the country. That helps us get employment.
New businesses, the governor says. Economic growth. Jobs. Some of those jobs are here at a nearly mile-long warehouse building near the Dayton International Airport. The facility belongs to Procter & Gamble, the Cincinnati-based global company behind dozens of familiar American brands.
Pampers, Tide, Pantene, Head & Shoulders, Gillette, Swiffer.
P&G spokesman Jeff Leroy says the company opened this facility a couple years ago to be closer to its customers.
Dayton is a crossroads for America. With Interstate 70 and 75 crossing here, this is a crossroads in the supply chain.
P&G calls this facility a mixing center. The mixing in the name refers not to the products themselves, but to the way they're shipped across the country.
What the mixing center enables us to do is take a blend of products that are produced at more than 20 locations across the United States and bring them all to one centric location here in Dayton. They're blended, they're mixed, so the retailer is getting a representation of P&G's total brand portfolio and not just a truckload of one or two products.
To see the Dayton Mixing Center in action, we head to the main floor. Workers in protective glasses and vests zoom by on motorized lift trucks and other machines in every direction for as far as the eye can see. They honk their horns at every intersection for safety as they maneuver around 83,000 shelves stacked high with shipping boxes. Riding in a golf cart, Leroy says Dayton's Mixing Center is one of six around the country P&G invested $500 million to build.
As we drive through, if you look straight ahead, you can see a tunnel and it has door after door after door. And it really gives you a feeling for the volume we have right here in North America.
That volume keeps the Mixing Center open day and night, with hundreds of 18-wheeler tractor-trailer trucks hauling loads in and out every day. The logistics are complicated.
This is an example of two different trucks that I want to talk about.
Mixing Center site leader Mark Byrne points to two trucks parked at a line of loading docks. One is loaded with only one product. It's a heavy liquid detergent. To account for the weight, the truck is less than half packed. There's a lot of empty space left.
This is how we shipped to all of our customers in the past, before 2.5 years ago.
The truck on the left is how P&G ships today, he says. It has what he calls a full mixed unit load, a mix of products at different weights, shapes, and sizes, allowing workers to use all available truck space safely. Byrne says the entire process runs according to minute-by-minute data from the company's advanced computer system.
It actually tells us how to go build the truck. So it understands the weight of the product, the dimensions of the box that it comes in, whether or not something's going to crush it or hurt it, and the U.S. Department of Transportation laws on how to ship product. We then fulfill that order based on what the customer said they want to put into their stores.
These complex calculations are triggered with every P&G item purchased anywhere in the world. Officials say mixing centers are dramatically reducing the time it takes for products to reach store shelves, and customers increasingly demanding fast home delivery of stuff they buy online. Mixing centers aren't new. The distribution system was first pioneered by consumer giants, including Walmart. But research shows they're having an even greater impact today, helped by the rise of big data, technology, and the analytics to harness it.
It takes less inventory now per dollar of sales than it did a generation ago.
That's Wright State professor Jim Hamister. He says the Miami Valley's location within reach of major population centers does give the region a strategic advantage in attracting jobs. Dayton Development Coalition numbers forecast the region's logistics industry will employ roughly 31,000 workers over the next year. And that could be a challenge. Hamister says as more and more companies look to leverage the country's faster, digitally connected supply chain, Dayton will need many more highly trained workers to fill those new data analytics-heavy jobs.
We really need that skilled worker set to support this, building the capability so we have the expertise in this area.
A recent report by consulting firm Deloitte and the Manufacturing Institute seems to back this up. The report predicts the manufacturing industry skills gap will leave 2 million jobs unfilled over the next decade. For WYSO, I'm Jess Mador.
I'm Jerry Kenney. This is WYSO Weekend on WYSO. Thanks for joining us. This week was Juneteenth, a national holiday celebrating African-American independence. Members from Dayton's Wesley Community Center celebrated Juneteenth last weekend with an emphasis on voting. WYSO's Sheila Raghavendran has more on the process of achieving freedom in America.
June 19, 1865 marks the day slavery was abolished in the United States. 153 years later, people across the country continue to celebrate this victory and recognize there is more work to be done.
It signifies a greater issue, which is that freedom is a process. It's not just an event.
That's Dr. James Dobbins, longtime Dayton Wesley Community Center member. He says there is still a need to fight for basic freedoms.
Voting is the one way where the average citizen can truly participate in power. And the deliberation of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
But the right to vote in Ohio is in jeopardy. The U.S. Supreme Court recently ruled that Ohio can take voters off registration rolls if they do not return a mailed address confirmation form and then do not vote for 4 years. Wesley Center Executive Director Yvette Kelly Fields says the court decision needs to be challenged.
When you start to roll back the ability for people to have a voice through purging voter registrations or gerrymandering so that certain groups have a leverage over other groups to be able to enact certain laws, rules, overturn rules and laws, that's the issue that in 2018 we have to actively work against, because if not, the whole point of having voting rights will become null and void.
Kelly Fields says other organizations in the area are actively working against the Supreme Court's decision, and the Wesley Center will make that information available to its members.
We're going to be sharing all the information to encourage people to get involved, that if this is an issue that you have concerns about, we want to help connect them to things that will allow them to take action.
Dobbins says another way to take action is to get involved with voter education and registration and knocking on doors for candidates.
That is what is going to make the difference in who holds the reins and the levers of power and authority in the country and in the communities where you live.
Kelly Fields and Dobbins both say the power and authority in the Emancipation Proclamation was only one part in the process for freedom. They say it's a fight that continued through the civil rights movement of the 1960s to today.
The fact that a lot of things that should have happened immediately following the Emancipation Proclamation, when you get down to the 1960s, it was an effort to go back and get the things that were supposed to be given and were promised in the 1860s.
I'm 72 years old. I remember traveling through the segregated South, and I remember my sister being a freedom rider. I remember my brother being the first African-American in a admitted to a closed trade union in this country, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, in 1967. It took that long for African-Americans to break into that kind of economic upward mobility.
Reaching that kind of upward mobility is exactly why the Wesley Center holds a Juneteenth celebration every year.
We took on Juneteenth to be a part of a continuum of different commemorative events all year long so that we can keep this in the conscious mind of people, to always be aware, to always remember, so that we can continue to fight for and advocate for justice and the continued part of freedom.
For WYSO, I'm Sheila Raghavendran.
Hey And this week on Senior Voices, Bertha Harris remembers a vibrant downtown Dayton and working at the historic Biltmore Hotel. Located at First and Main, the Biltmore was one of the most well-known hotels in the country before it converted to senior apartments in 1981. More recently, Bertha's strong family ties helped her through a life-changing experience. She shared her memories with Dayton Metro Library interviewer and project liaison Janine Kinnison.
I remember all the stores. I used to love to go to downtown. My mother's sister used to come from Kentucky here to shop because we had so many stores. Wrights used to have their display for Christmas and the hot chocolate and the cookies. Mm-hmm. I mean, I remember all that. And I remember I used to take my kids there on Saturdays. My oldest daughter used to love the hot fudge sundaes at Frisch's, and that was their treat. I never will forget that. I tell my grandkids about that now, how downtown used to be so full of life. Yeah, I worked at the Biltmore downtown. I worked there for about 8 years. Whenever they converted over to make it a senior citizen a building, the Biltmore was a fabulous place. Chandeliers, the doormen, the Shriners used to come there. Good tipping. I won a lot of awards for being a good, at that time they were saying, a housekeeper maid. I met Barry White, I met him, but it was a fabulous place at one time, it really was. I enjoyed working there for those years. September 2016, I was in a very bad car accident, and I thank God that I'm still here, me and my oldest daughter. It was a real bad accident. It could have been fatal. I think about that so much, how it made me more humble in life, and I had to learn how to walk again. I was in a nursing home for 3 months. I know how it is to be in a wheelchair. I know how it is to be in a boot and just be in a nursing home, period. And I used to work in a nursing home all those years. But then when you walk in them shoes, you really understand, truly understand them. Mm-hmm. You really do. When I went in surgery and when I came out, it was a 5-hour surgery. My pastor and the first lady were there. They read the Bible to me. It was just always someone there bringing me flowers, bringing me food. It was awesome. And, you know, one of the aides there asked me one day, she said, "Miss Bertha," she said, "I know you're a nice lady, but you must be awful awesome because you always got visitors." I said, "This, I'm going to tell you what my father used to tell me. Whatever you put out, that's what you're going to get back." And I think about it quite often. It changed my whole life because I was working part-time. And, you know, right now I can't even work. But I got to see them move forward. I can't go backwards. I can't change anything that's happened. I might not walk the way I want to, but I'm walking. And I just thank God that I'm still here and I had a good church family and family to support me, because you can't go through something like that by yourself.
That was 67-year-old Bertha Harris speaking with Janine Kinnison as part of the Senior Voices Project. This interview was edited by Community Voices producer Tess Cortez. Senior Voices is a collaboration between the Dayton Metro Library, Rebuilding Together Dayton, and WYSO. The series is made possible through the generous support of the Delmar Healthcare Fund of the Dayton Foundation.
This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac for the fourth week of early summer, the second week of the turtle hatching moon, and the first week of the sun in Cancer. These are the longest days of the year, and Thursday, the 21st, is solstice, the peak of the solar tides splitting Earth's time in two. the sun leaving early summer in Gemini and entering deep summer in Cancer. Obscured by daylight, the constellations that accompany the sign of Cancer during the day include Orion in the middle of the southern sky at noon, with the potent dog star Sirius low behind him. When Pisces lies in the west and Leo in the east and Draco in the north. Even though these star groups may be invisible in the sunlight, the landscape on Earth offers markers that reveal the sky map hidden in the light of the longest days of the year. The orange ditch lilies, accompanied by pink-flowered thistles and yellow sweet clover, track the stellar course and bookend the solar passage of early summer. Those common flowers begin their flowering at the close of May, come to full bloom just before solstice, and then give way to the easy markers of July. The white Queen Anne's lace and the yellow black-eyed Susans that dominate the roadsides well into Leo in the dog days of summer. And so the landscape itself is the sky chart. If you look at the flowers around you, you become an astronomer. This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. I'll be back again next week with notes for the first week of deep summer. In the meantime, look for lilies in the fields. Their petals are simple signs of solstice. And to follow July day by day, you can purchase my July day book on Amazon. Find it by searching under Bill Felker.
Bill Felker contributes to newspapers nationwide, including the Yellow Springs News. Bill resides in Yellow Springs. Poor Will's Almanac is also available as a podcast at WYSO.org.
That's it for this edition of WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world since 1958, thanks to generous listeners like you. I'm Jerry Kenny. We'll be back next Sunday morning at 10. Coming up next on WYSO, it's Vic McCunis with the Book Nook.
This year on WYSO, we're taking you to the small towns and rural communities in our listening area.
You know, you're preserving not only the habitat, not only the bird itself, but you're preserving a way of life, you know.
Stories that are fun, engaging, that go beyond the stereotypes.
This is a dream come true, be out here with a good buddy and friends and hunting like I wanted to do when I was a kid. So
I'm Renee Wild. Join me for County Lines, a year-long series on 91.3 WYSO.
Do you know of a teenager who would like to go behind the scenes and find out what it takes to produce their very own radio and podcast stories? Then you might be interested in the Dayton Youth Radio Summer Camp. It's one full week of hands-on training from NPR and YSO producers. Spaces are limited for the Dayton Youth Radio Summer Camp. Go to the WYSO.org website. Oh, did I say it's going to be fun?
I'm Juliet Frumhold. Join me on a musical journey every Sunday night on Alphorithms. We'll go far out to the edges of space, time, and genre, and make it back home before the weekend is over. Come along, Sunday nights from 8 to 11 on Alphorithms on WYSO.
I feel the liftoff. The clock has started. Roger.
This is Judd Plattenberg of Oregon Printing in Dayton, Ohio. I never cease to be amazed with the new business that comes in the door because people have heard us on WYSO. If you own a business, I think WYSO is a great place to direct your marketing dollars. To me, it's a true investment that really does yield a great return.
To learn more about how to take your business public, contact me, Karen Bledsoe, at WYSO.org.